and Jordanians gather outside the Israeli embassy in the capital Amman for a fifth consecutive night, calling on their government to cancel all treaties and ties with Israel. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. It's nearly 6 months now into Israel's genocidal onslaught on Gaza, and the regime strikes are still killing and injuring civilians throughout the besieged enclave. Latest Israeli airstrikes killed at least 12 Palestinians in a home in Rafah in southern Gaza. Eyewitnesses reported about 30 people killed by strikes in an industrial zone east of Gaza City. 8 people were also killed after occupation forces bombed a home in the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli genocide has so far killed over 32,623 people and left nearly 75,000 others injured, and 7,000 people are still unaccounted for and feared buried under rubble. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent, Moti Abu Musab, in central Gaza City, Deir al-Balah. He says Israel continues targeting Rafah, despite knowing the city is currently housing near the 1.5 million displaced Palestinians.
Let's begin with Rafah City. As the Israeli warplanes carried out several rural airstrikes against a residential building located in Al-Nasr neighborhood, which is located in the northern part of Rafah City. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery maintained shelling the eastern part of the city of Rafah City with more intense shelling that reached the residential buildings there, knowing that Rafah is still accepting roughly 1.4 million Palestinian evacuees who are still taking shelter in that area amid the continuous airstrikes and attacks. When it comes to Khan Yunis City, the current situation is still dreadful as the Israeli warplanes maintained carrying out several airstrikes against the western part of the city, particularly the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex and the Al Amal Hospital. Those areas have been subjected to heavy bombardments and attacks for the last 3 consecutive days after the Israeli occupation forces reiterated their ground offensive against that area. Needless to mention that the vast majority of the buildings there were completely destroyed over the ceaseless and the incessant Israeli attacks and airstrikes. Even in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City, particularly Al-Karara neighborhood, it was subjected to heavy attacks of the Israeli artillery over the last night. When it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces also committed another appalling massacre against the Palestinian civilians, particularly in Al-Maghazi refugee camp. In Gaza City, the current situation is still over catastrophic as the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the Ashifa Square and the surrounding areas for the successive 12th consecutive day with more airstrikes, more shelling and more gunfire towards the residential buildings there.
They're breaking news that some updates on the death toll and also 71 people killed and over 112 wounded in Israeli attacks in the last 24 hours in Gaza. And the death toll also, I mentioned, it's up to 32,623 now. I mean, our news item, written just a couple hours ago, was at 32,500. This onslaught is resulting in mass casualties on a daily basis. Meanwhile, president of the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders says there is no change on the ground in Gaza despite a recent UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire and a flow of aid.
We haven't seen any change after this resolution on the ground. We haven't seen any impact in the people's lives there every day. We haven't seen any impact in our ways of delivering the humanitarian aid. The situation remains the same, and our asks remain the same. And these are the sustained, immediate ceasefire. We want to stop being attacked in our medical facilities. We want to stop being attacked with our medical staff. We have to protect the people that they provide the medical healthcare in the Gazan population, and we would like to have an unhindered humanitarian aid delivery in Gaza at this moment. which is not the case at all. We try also to meet primary health needs of the population. And I will give you an example that really shocked the international community when they saw that pregnant women, that they have to undergo a cesarean section, they had to be literally kicked out of the hospital after a couple of hours because there were no beds. Now MSF has increased the capacity of beds in order to offer at least some quality of care to these women.
Hamas has hailed a ruling by the International Court of Justice ordering the Israeli regime to address famine in Gaza. The resistance group has called on the international community to create a mechanism to ensure the order's implementation. In a statement, Hamas said Israel must be forced to immediately execute the court's order. It said Israel is a fascist occupation entity that uses starvation as a weapon against civilians. Hamas lamented the regime has consistently disregarded all international resolutions, including the recent resolution by the UN Security Council calling for a humanitarian ceasefire for the holy month of Ramadan. Groups said U.S. cover for Israel's made terrorist regime behave in such a way as if it is above the law and accountability. Reaction comes after the ICJ ordered Israel to allow immediate delivery of humanitarian supplies into the besieged territory. Court said that famine has now turned from a risk into a chronic crisis for the civilian population of Gaza. Court's order urged Israel to ensure unhindered provision of food, water, electricity, and medical supplies to Palestinians. Limited access to clean water amid unrelenting Israeli bombardments poses a serious risk to Gazans throughout the besieged territory. Now, some displaced Palestinians explain their hardship and how they struggle to gain access to drinkable water.
There is no fresh water in the school that shelters refugees. That's why we come here to fill water. It comes only half an hour a day. Water in the school is undrinkable. It's salty. What can we do? We have to walk 1 kilometer to get water.
People are suffering because of lack of water, considering it's salty too. We fill water in gallons instead of water tanks. It is really a suffering when it comes to obtaining fresh water. We have to queue for everything. We walk for an hour in total. Sometimes we return empty-handed without water.
We are in the month of Ramadan and we are struggling to get water to our homes. It is difficult and we are suffering from a great deal of hardship. We don't even have food to give us the energy to go collect the water, let alone the innocent children, women, and the elderly.
Our problem with water has been a serious problem since the war began. Not just today. We are suffering a lot from water because all pipes and pumps stopped working since the beginning of the war.
More than 140 Christian leaders from throughout the world have called for a comprehensive and permanent ceasefire in Gaza and end to foreign military support for Israel. In a letter, the group slammed empty rhetoric of world leaders who ignore underlying causes of the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. The Christian leader said Israel's daily bombings and shutting off basic life-sustaining services to Gazans are the direct causes of the crisis. The letter urged world leaders not to be silent as people continue to die. It demanded an end to Israeli atrocities, violence, death, and destruction in Gaza. The Christian leaders also called for immediate and adequate humanitarian assistance to more than 2 million Palestinians in the territory. Political commentator Charlotte Cates says organizations and institutions around the world are recognizing the reality of Israel's genocide taking place against Gazans.
It's certainly significant and reflective of the fact that organizations and institutions around the world can recognize the reality that's in front of all of our eyes. That is that the Zionist regime is committing genocide in Gaza on a daily basis, and that the Palestinian people are facing a genocidal regime. Now, of course, there are Muslims, Christians, Jews, people of all and no faiths around the world who are taking to the streets, mobilizing and organizing. In North America, many Christian organizations are having processions to stop the genocide in Gaza this weekend for Easter weekend. I mean, churches have been bombed and targeted by the occupation in Gaza. So it's about time that Christian leadership are following in the footsteps of Christian populations and communities who have been coming out and participating in mass in the major demonstrations that have been taking place in essentially every capital and major city in the world for the past 6 months. The reason is clear, the answer is clear, this is genocide. In terms of whether it's going to have an effect, I mean, every institution taking a position, it's time to really step up the position and also implement a boycott of Israel, a boycott of so-called interfaith activities that serve only not to actually bring people of all faiths together, but serve the purpose of whitewashing the Zionist regime and the Israeli occupation.
Meanwhile, for a fifth night now in a row, hundreds of Jordanians have demonstrated near the Israeli embassy in Amman to voice support for Palestinians in Gaza. Protesters oppose normalization of Jordan's relations with Israel while strongly condemning the regime's crimes in Gaza, especially brutal attacks to its slogans, and wave Palestinian and Jordanian flags. They also reiterated their demand for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and closure of the Israeli embassy. Jordanian riot police, however, blocked the march toward the regime's embassy. For months, Jordanians have been calling on authorities to cancel all treaties and ties with Israel and not allow the regime to use Jordan to transit its goods through. Jordan, which hosts over 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed numerous pro-Palestine rallies since Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza back in early October. Israel's launched a fresh air attack on Syria, this time targeting a number of locations in the northwestern city of Aleppo. According to the Syrian military, attacks left a number of civilians and military personnel dead and wounded and damaged both public and private property. The military said Israeli aggression coincided with a drone attack by terrorist organizations launched from Idlib and the western Aleppo countryside. It added the terrorists intended to target civilians in the city of Aleppo and its surroundings. In the past, Damascus said such coincided attacks by Israel and the terrorists shows a close coordination between the two. Syria has also said that repeated Israeli aggression is aimed at propping up the terrorists in the Arab country. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and Israeli forces once again exchanged fire as tensions remain high over the war in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military has targeted a vehicle in the city of Tyre with a drone. The Lebanese media reported retaliatory Hezbollah missile strikes on Israeli positions in the occupied Sheba farms. And for more on the story, we are now going to swing over to our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh. Hello, Mariam. Hope you're safe and doing well. What can you tell us with respect to the latest clashes between the two?
In the town of Azouri, which is in the area of Tyre in South Lebanon, it's clear that it was an assassination. However, we do not know whether the main figure that was assassinated was a Lebanese member of the Lebanese resistance or the Palestinian resistance. That comes as part of the wave, the routine assassinations that the Israelis have been launching against Lebanon. Hezbollah has responded also, or as part even of their routine operations against a target in the Sheba farms, against the barracks of Zibdin specifically. The first time they targeted it with the guided missiles, the second time it was with a Falak rocket. But the most significant development, which is linked to this confrontation, is that we saw yesterday Hezbollah used for the first time, the Israeli media actually said that in the last 2 days, Hezbollah targeted the Israeli settlements using heavy rockets like Falak, like Burkan, for example, also. And that was the first time, as Israeli media is saying, instead of using Katyusha rockets, they are using more heavier rockets that would lead to more destruction in the settlements, not only against military targets. The Israelis said they had lost patience, but the night before, of course, they had already committed two massacres in Al-Naqoura and other areas. And before that, we had the massacre of the medical personnel, medical facility in Hibeiri, also in South Lebanon. And so it seems that there is this ping pong actions and military reactions from Hezbollah as well, who said that they will not also tolerate these continuous attacks against the medical personnel and launch these heavy rockets against the settlements as well. And we saw that there was images coming out from the settlements, how we had huge destruction and a lot of areas which even led to the killing of settlers and not only military personnel. But the most significant development recently was the attack on Aleppo. That also is linked, since the Israelis seemingly, when we see that they do not have a clear target in Lebanon, they use targeting Syrian areas. So we have a targeting in Aleppo. We know that there is news of Hezbollah fighters falling in that area, but there is also a huge number of Syrians who were near that vicinity, and other attacks, of course, that were taken on. And it seems that we are looking at a joint operation for the Israeli Air Force and the Syrian terrorist elements within Syria. And so that is basically narrowing the gap between those two sides. The terrorist groups used drones, as we know, against those targets, which could have led also to civilians among the Syrians that were killed, in addition to the fact that they were coordinating through the areas of the U.S. bases in Tanf and the using the airspace of Jordan. And so this basically brings somewhat of a picture where we see the Israelis coordinating with those sides in order to launch more attacks against the resistance front as a whole, which is unifying.
All right, thank you, Maryam, for that update. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Maryam Saleh there joining us from Beirut. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
As the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza enters its 6th month, the impact on Palestinian children has been devastating. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, UN agencies report that, following the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza, at least 17,000 Palestinian children have been orphaned or separated from relatives, and 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished. The health ministry in Gaza reported that 23 children died from malnutrition and dehydration in recent weeks. At least 32,000 people killed in Gaza, over 13,000 are children. The UN has warned that nearly 580,000 Palestinians, a quarter of Gaza's population, are one step away from famine. There are many such horrible recollections. The psychological trauma rooted in the ravages of war are scars that last a lifetime for children. The Zionist regime continues to block humanitarian aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza and has attacked Palestinians attempting to receive aid. The last day of February witnessed Israeli regime forces massacring over 100 unarmed Palestinians, queuing for flour and humanitarian assistance. 3 days later, the Zionist regime killed 9 Palestinian civilians in line for flour in 2 separate attacks. Having already vetoed 3 UN Security Council resolutions for a ceasefire, the Biden administration also blocked a statement that condemned the flour bag massacre, as it did not have all the facts yet on the ground. Even though Washington has supplied the Zionist regime military with massive quantities of munitions and political cover, it has consistently claimed that it is unable to influence Israeli regime policy. Instead, the Biden administration initiated airdrops of ready meals into Rafah. The airdrops are not even close to sufficient considering the dire needs of the population. And on March 8, the falling crates killed 5 people, including 2 children, when a parachute or parachutes failed to open. Biden's proposed temporary port will take weeks to complete as disease and malnourishment grow. Meanwhile, the child killer regime of Israel has continued its campaign and is employing American weapons. As the first aid drops were delivered, an Israeli drone strike targeted Palestinians huddling in tents outside Rafah's Emirati hospital. At least 11 civilians, including children and 2 health workers, were killed, and at least 50 people were injured. For 5 months, the Biden administration has defended Israel's actions and offered only muted criticism. Washington has remained steadfast in its support, despite the overwhelming evidence of war crimes, including the determination by the International Court of Justice of a genocide. Spokespersons for the White House, State Department, and National Security Council, as well as President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have repeatedly dismissed or diminished reports by the United Nations, journalists, and humanitarian organizations of the humanitarian catastrophe that has been live-streamed to a horrified global audience. Even after the flour bag massacre, NSC spokesman John Kirby insisted that Israel has tried to help with the delivery of humanitarian assistance, yet a handful of Israeli protesters have been successful in blocking aid trucks from entering Gaza. The carnival-like atmosphere of these Israeli protesters at the border crossing has occurred in full view of international media as well as the Zionist regime's military. The child killer regime of Israel has also prevented basic necessities from entering Gaza and contributed to the pain and suffering of Palestinian children. CNN has reported that maternity kits, sleeping bags, and equipments have been barred from entering Gaza. Anesthetics, oxygen cylinders, and crutches are also on the list of rejected items. The shocking scenes of children undergoing surgical procedures and amputations without anesthesia have now become routine, as has the acronym WCNSF for Wounded Child with No Surviving Family. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, 6 November, warning that Gaza was becoming a graveyard for children, has been realized. Hent Rajab, a 6-year-old girl, who called begging for help after the Zionist regime troops targeted the car in which she and her family were traveling, was killed after a long wait along with the paramedics who went to save her. Infants like 45-day-old Mahmoud Fatou, who died due to severe dehydration and malnutrition, or Ahmad, a child who was rescued after 9 days under the rubble, a skeleton, or Talin 10, who recognized her mother's body by the hair. And there are countless stories of mothers who held their children in arms when they took their last breath. And this is only a partial telling. There are thousands of others whose stories we don't know. With thousands still buried under the rubble, the stories of many of the dead children may never be told. Yet the Biden administration repeatedly insists it needs more evidence before it can condemn or criticize the Zionist regime's actions. Standards it has not applied to Palestinians or UN agencies or the ICJ. Children in Gaza have suffered the loss of their closest family members, in many cases their parents, siblings, grandparents, and other relatives. Their homes and schools have been destroyed, their neighbors killed or displaced. Their books and toys have been lost, their pets have been killed, their favorite park has been razed. Under constant bombardment, the Palestinian children are still grappling with the greatest challenges of siege, destruction, displacement, and starvation. These challenges will only increase in the weeks and months after the fighting ends, and the children will never forgive the silence and complicity of Western regimes who supported the Zionist regime's actions.
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims, and forcing the men to watch it. That's, while being, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, you know, the enemy of the people of Esther. So every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself. The very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization, just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance. Because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith, and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
Well, that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon. And even now, we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guest in Los Angeles spoke about, this optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world, so they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in, and the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much unfortunately compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. We see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber really when the rubber meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They have ties to. They were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to open up to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed the second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran and, to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansarullah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will have no problem with Ansarullah. And Ansarullah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansarullah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy, and then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism, and thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansarullah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate attention, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwwa.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala al-a'immat al-du'at.
Peace be upon the imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, his select, his party, the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the 10th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. His Eminence spoke about a great many different things when it comes to various different fields of Islam, whether it is the scientific fields or the philosophical fields, the theological fields, the jurisprudential fields, and of course, when it came to the fields of ethics, morality, and akhlaq, as it is known in the Arabic. So there's a very beautiful conversation that Imam al-Hadi has with one of his companions. And in this conversation with his companion, they're talking about quite a few different things overall. But eventually there comes this one place where Imam al-Hadi talks about one of the first and perhaps most fundamental blessings that Allah the Almighty has given for humankind. And so His Eminence says that the first blessing of Allah for humankind is the soundness of their mind, and their preference to all other creatures is because of the potential perfection of the mind of a human being and their faculty of speaking. So what a beautiful, you know, and interesting statement here, you know, we have from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. He continues and he talks about how every living creature in the earth is independent in its senses and is complete in its being, every living creature. But humankind has been preferred because of their faculty of speaking when it comes to all other creatures. And it is because of this faculty of speaking that Allah has made humankind prevail over all other creatures. And thus, humankind is the commander and the creatures are submissive to him. And even a verse from the Holy Quran talks about how, you know, Allah has made the various creatures of the world subservient to humankind and human beings. This beautiful, you know, statement here from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam talking about speech and how speech is this honor, it is this nobility, and it is this faculty, this blessing, you know, that Allah has given to a human being. And really what a blessing it is, because it is the most fundamental form of communication, language, being able to hear and comprehend, being able to speak. You know, this communication here is something which is, I mean, it's very important. I think many a times we don't really, you know, take it into consideration. We don't really give value to speech when we really, you know, we should thank the Almighty Allah for this faculty of being able to speak. And matter of fact, speech and communication, it is the fundamental manner in which Allah the Almighty is communicating with humanity. So no other animal or no other creature has the potential to be able to communicate with the Almighty Allah because they don't have speech, even though